Hello, and welcome to Doc Talk. My name is Juliana Grassi, and today I speak with Cindy Steinberg, the National Director of Policy and Advocacy for the U.S. Pain Foundation. Just last month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention proposed new clinical guidelines for prescribing opioids for pain management. The guideline is not yet official, as the government has just opened the docket to accept comments from the public regarding these proposals. While its purpose is to serve as a clinical tool for providers, the recommendations are voluntary. The CDC emphasized that they are intended as flexible standards of care and should not replace clinical judgment or individualized patient-centered care. After the original version was published in 2016, many states took these recommendations as a rule and established laws based on them. Cindy shares her professional insight on each version of this guideline and the changes that have been made and revised.
I know we're here to talk about the CDC guideline. I was hoping we could discuss what that process is like, how the proposal process works, and if you think that there will be any changes from what's been proposed to what is finalized.
So there's a couple of steps in this process. Just to sort of quickly review, the original guideline was released in March of 2016, and that was a final. There had been sort of a comment period. And then that has been out for several years now, so all that time. And that's, 6 years already. And then they announced that they were going to release a new version. And so they had sort of a draft version that they used at a meeting in July. But then they said they want to go back and make further changes. And they finally released this version on February 10th. So this is going to replace the 2016 version. Mm-hmm. According to federal rules, they have to have it out for a 60-day comment period. So we are in the 60-day comment period. It will receive comments, we'll review them, and then release the final. So this is a draft revised version.
And so the 2016 version went through the same type of process?
Yes.
Okay. I was wondering if you can comment on any notable changes that you've noticed in the current revised one.
Yes. So the current revised one is has more recognition of individual differences in response to medication, and is a bit less strict or dogmatic, you might say, is a bit more flexible in looking at individual differences.
Okay. And would you consider any of these revisions to be improvements from the previous one, or any that maybe could be problematic? Is there any that stand out to you as being beneficial or not?
Yes. So I think that the changes that they've made are all improvements on the 2016. And I can give you examples. Okay. The biggest example is that they have backed away from the dosage cautions and limits that they had in the previous version. So now they've taken those out. They had a caution at 50 MME, which is the morphine equivalence, and 90, they cautioned strongly never to go above, but they've removed those limits. And I can tell you the history of probably what led to that. Mm-hmm. They've also changed the duration. They've taken out the day duration for acute opioid prescribing. You likely don't need more than 3 days and you should rarely need more than 7 days for acute pain. So they've taken out those days. Mm-hmm. Those are the biggest changes, and they have gotten the greatest criticism over the past 6 years since they've been out. They've also caused the biggest problems with people with pain. Some other changes, and I can go into any of that. Some other changes that they've made is added cautions about tapering. And so another big problem before was in an effort to sort of be under those dosage limits, a lot of people were force tapered off of opioids that they had been on. And so they now are cautioning to go slow when they when you taper somebody off of opioids or down from their dosage. So that's another change that they've made. They've loosened the surveillance a bit. So in what I mean by surveillance is that the previous guideline said that you should check the prescription monitoring program to check whether patients are actually taking the medication as prescribed, either every script or at least every 3 months. And now they've loosened that to say that you should check it periodically, recommending every 3 months. Also, they've talked a lot about urine drug screening last time, and now they're just saying, you know, toxicology, but they're loosening the when, you know, how often you should do that. So those were sort of the main changes from previous. So if you wanted to understand sort of the impact of those and why I think they made those particular changes, as I had mentioned, over these years, because of those limits, physicians fearful of scrutiny for being over a certain dosage were tapering people off, tapering people down. And the sad thing is that those were very arbitrary and they received a lot of criticism. There was no scientific basis on which they chose the 50 and 90. There's no sort of difference between, you know, 80 and 100 in terms of how it affects individual patients. Mm-hmm. And so as you can imagine, if somebody has a progressive disease and, you know, somebody is just starting this disease and they have less pain and somebody has a lot more pain when their disease has progressed, should you give them the same amount of dosage? If somebody weighs 80 pounds and somebody weighs 300 pounds, why would you have it one specific dosage cutoff? And so there was a lot of problems with those. And then also the tapering was a huge problem. In fact, it was such a problem that the FDA issued a warning to doctors in April of 2019 because so many people were being forced off of opioids who had been on many cases stable dosages for years. Mm-hmm. And we heard from hundreds of patients who were negatively impacted by these guidelines.
I know that the previous guideline from 2016 did have an extensive impact.
Yes, and in fact, because before they were even released, pain specialists and people like myself who follow pain policy very closely were very concerned about the CDC doing these. It is very unusual for the CDC to do practice guidelines. Typically, these are done by medical associations and people familiar with the area. In this case, the CDC stepping into this area and doing guidelines, I think people took a lot more seriously when it had the CDC's, you know, imprimatur on it. And so people followed, doctors followed those very strictly. There's also been a lot of surveillance of doctors, watching what they're prescribing. These guidelines were made into law in at least 33 states.
Right. And I was going to ask you about that, and I was hoping that you could explain a little bit about that to your knowledge, about how that impacted different states and physicians differently, because some states took it so seriously that they did implement this into law, right?
Yes. So, CDC basically coming out with this in the height of the, you know, opioid crisis, lawmakers were urged to, you know, cut back on opioid prescribing. And so they, in their, you know, rush to do something about the opioid crisis, didn't really understand the nuance between people living with chronic pain, people in acute pain, and, you know, people that abusing the medication. And so they just started implementing strict rules and laws to force people off of opioid prescribing and felt backed up by having the CDC guidelines. The very sad thing is that there are no pain specialists that created these guidelines. The five authors of this are injury prevention specialists. For the most part, pain doctors, pain advocates, pain patients were excluded from the process of creating these guidelines, both the first time and now this time. They had a review committee that had some people with pain management experience on it, but they, you know, did not author these guidelines. So the first version, there was no one really with pain management experience writing these. And so that is, you know, kind of part of the reason why they had such a negative impact, I think.
So in that first version, there was no review period like now, or it wasn't?
There was a review period, but the authorship of the guidelines themselves, unlike most practice guidelines that are authored by, let's say, rheumatologists who do rheumatology guidelines, or, gastroenterologists who, the associations that are familiar with them do them. In this case, these are injury prevention specialists at CDC that took it upon themselves to create these guidelines for pain management, essentially. And they did not include people with pain. And in the first process, they excluded pain management physicians and pain patients and pain advocates from the authorship. And then in the review process, it's a public comment period. There were thousands and thousands of comments pointing out the problems with these, but they went ahead and did them anyway. And it was predictable what was going to happen. And it's had a very negative impact on, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people living with pain.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know pain really does span such a wide array of conditions and specialties and fields of diseases. So I guess I was wondering your opinion on how, like, what would the ideal way be to kind of come up with these?
The ideal way to come up with these is kind of what was done with a different panel that I will talk about later that did come out with some really great pain management recommendations. But really, from my perspective, it would be to have pain management physicians, people, let's say, apply and then reviewed by a pain management physician to choose people, pain advocates, pain patients. These are all the people that use these medications legitimately long-term. There's a difference between acute pain and chronic pain. So it would be important to have acute pain specialists and chronic pain specialists on a drafting committee and then open it up for public comment. So the example I'll give you is because these created such controversy and thousands of letters were written to different societies, to even the AMA. I can talk about their view of this. Over the years since the guidelines had been published, such that Congress in CARA, which was one of the first federal opioid bill that was in 2016, had the very first section of it was for a pain management panel to be appointed to come up with what are best practices in pain management for the nation. And so Congress mandated a subsequent report that came out in 2019 and asked that committee to review the CDC guidelines. There were 29 people appointed to that committee. The first thing HHS did was they brought in a Stanford pain physician to head up that. And then she was part of choosing the people that were going to be on that. I was appointed to that. I was the only pain advocate on it. Most of the others were all doctors. It was interagency, so there was somebody representing every one of the federal health agencies on that report. And our report came out in 2019 and was like lauded by over 160 organizations supported the report. The AMA came out with a press release the day the report came out, saying that they thought this was a roadmap for future policy. And we reviewed the CDC guidelines and, you know, very carefully talked about what the problems and issues had been with them, and then recommended a very individualistic, multimodal approach to pain management. Opioids are just one thing in a panoply of, you know, many different treatments for pain, including, you know, medications, interventional procedures, complementary medicine procedure, therapies, behavioral therapies, et cetera. And the best way to manage pain is really to combine a number of different approaches. And if each thing takes down your pain another 15, 10%, you know, that might add up to like a 50% reduction in pain, which could make the difference between being able to work or not, you know, being able to take care of your family or not. Mm-hmm. And so that was a process that was very successful and very well done, as opposed to the process of the CDC guidelines.
And how did that report hold up in comparison to, did it have the same kind of impact as these guidelines did?
It didn't have the same kind of an impact. Unfortunately, it has not gotten, it was, the final report was released just before the pandemic in 2019, kind of got forgotten in everything that has happened since. And when the CDC guidelines came out, there was a lot of money given to CDC to roll these out and make sure that they were distributed to every state, that every public health department got trained on these, that every medical board knew about these. So there was a huge effort by the CDC to be sure those guidelines were really, you know, incorporated into practice. And with this report, sadly, there hasn't been that kind of an effort. There should be, because doctors get very little training in pain management in medical school, and oftentimes don't know what to do about pain. So when they were told to, you know, pretty much cut back on their opioids, what patients confronted was many doctors that didn't know how to alternately treat pain and were so concerned about it that they basically turned patients away. Mm-hmm. So it would be fantastic if that report, it's called, it has a long name, but it's called the HHS Pain Management Best Practices Interagency Task Force Report. And you know, that report, I think, is a very, you know, very positive and a very good way to manage pain. And most people agree that is the most successful way to manage pain.
The ultimate goal is to practice the safety behind prescribing opioids because of, you know, issues with the opioid epidemic and the addictive qualities of it. I was wondering if there were any studies that you were aware of, you know, during this time since the 2016 guidelines were implemented, like, has there been any evidence to show that they were helping in specific areas that were maybe implementing them more so with the opioid epidemic, or has there been any sort of evaluation of that?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess I can say there are some positives about the guidelines and their effect, and then, you know, some negatives. The positives, I think, were on the acute side largely, because mm-hmm. I think there was a recognition amongst dentists and doctors that might not have confronted, you know, really serious pain, to understand that for acute pain situations that it would be important to not prescribe too many pills when only a few were needed. And I think there was a recognition of that, and that was a big change. There should have been an acute guideline and a chronic guideline, because they're quite different in handling pain. The truth is, that doesn't really get out, that studies, repeated studies, have shown that for people that are medically managed on with chronic pain that use opioids, the studies show that anywhere between less than 1% to 8% of people end up addicted to the medication. And so people that are taking these medications for pain have a very little incidence of getting addicted to these medications. You know, the people that do run into problems are people that have substance use disorder that, let's say, get pain and then get access to the medication, or have substance use disorder and intentionally, you know, misuse the medication to satisfy their craving for a high. And, you know, this can be illustrated with the fact that we have reduced prescribing largely because of the guidelines since 2016 to between 45 and 60%. So there's been a huge reduction, yet substance use disorder and overdose have increased. Why is that? And sadly, it's because people that have the disease of substance use disorder have switched to what's available. You can't get prescription pills anymore. It's very hard to. And so sadly, they've switched to what's available on the street, which is illicit fentanyl and heroin and combinations, polypharmacy. So if you look at the data now, the data clearly shows that almost all of overdose is illicit substances. So the truth is that people taking it for chronic pain, it is one of the most effective things we have. It doesn't help everyone with pain, but, you know, in 2014, NIH estimated that between 5 and 8 million people with chronic pain were on long-term opioid therapy. And so, you know, there's 2 million people with substance use, with opioid use disorder in this country, and 50 million with pain, and 19.6 million with high impact chronic pain. And sadly, that message, you know, just got, you know, smothered in the complete, you know, overreaction, I think, on the medical side to opioids.
Definitely. Yeah, it seems so. I feel like I can continue talking about this for a while because there's so much to discuss here. I was wondering if there's anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to address before we wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing that could happen would be for that task force report that I talked about to be disseminated. And we are trying to sort of get pain advocates are trying to get that report disseminated, because as I mentioned, doctors do get very little education in pain management. In fact, one of the best studies that was done in this looked at all different countries and found that the average number of hours of pain management in medical schools taught is 11 hours. And veterinarians get 87 hours. So, you know, your pet is getting better pain management than people. And it's sad that that's the case. But if that report, which talks about a full range of options for treating pain and how this should be very individualized, got out and doctors understood that opioids do have a place, but there are other medications that also work, and that there's many other treatments that help people. For pretty severe pain, you need some sort of a medication, whether it's opioids or other things. But that would be the best thing, which is having doctors really read that report and understand there's a full range of options. And it would be best to manage people with a multimodal approach, you know, rather than dropping patients and just thinking that it's either opioids or nothing. So I think that would be really important.
Thank you, Cindy Steinberg, for joining us on Doc Talk today. We'll be back next week, and thank you for listening.